S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shimma, shimma! Shimma, shimma! Shimma, shimma!
Let me in!
Shimma, shimma!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shimma, shimma!
Open up your soul!
Shimma, shimma!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Audiences for hundreds of years have enjoyed A Midsummer Night's Dream, and so people are always happy to give you another version of it to thrill you and fulfill you. And I've got two people here to talk about it to thrill you and fulfill you. I'd like to welcome director William Hodgson and actress Celeste Camilla. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you. How about...
Hi there. Happy to be here.
So for our listening audience who may be young and have not yet experienced the joys of A Midsummer Night's Dream, why don't you, as the director, tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so Midsummer Night's Dream is a story about these young couples that are faced with some pretty egregious rules from society, and they decide they have to run away into the forest to sort of elope. And it's more of a, there's a love triangle in there. It's not so clean as that, but in the forest, they're met with magic and they realize who their true loves are, and everything kind of works out in the end. It's one of my favorite comedies from Shakespeare. I don't know, Celeste, do you have anything to say about it?
Yeah. In addition to the lovers, there's also a couple, there's several storylines going on that are all equally kind of ridiculous and entertaining. Mm-hmm. There's also a group of wannabe actors, shall we say, who are working to put on a play to present for the wedding that happens at the end of the show. And hilarity ensues when they meet the fairies that are in the forest also. And the fairies are sort of the catalyst that causes all of the missed connections and hilarity that happens in the forest.
Okay, so A Midsummer Night's Dream, again, delights audiences. And every time I've seen a version, an iteration of Midsummer Night's Dream, people have always put a little bit of their own stank on it, which I always enjoy. So what have you guys done with it for our entertainment?
Well, I think when I first kind of approached this play for Shotgun, I was really struck with the Hippolyta Theseus myth that bookends the play. We start with a wedding is announced in four moons, and then we have the wedding by the end. But looking at that myth, it's really unsatisfying. Like every iteration of it, either she betrays Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons, betrays her country, or she's taken as a prisoner by Theseus, or there's something really complex in their love story. But I loved that in Shakespeare's ritual, this play that we produce so much in America, it is always framed as a love story. Over the course of this play, something happens to take that disharmonious love story and make it harmonious. And that felt like really necessary for our community. Mm. So I've been really excited to invite a bunch of really bold actors who are have strong ideas about these characters and kind of break that down, make a Midsummer that is as complex as we know ourselves to be today.
So, Celeste, do you count yourself among the bold actors who, with a very definite idea of what your character should be doing?
Well, I'm very flattered to be counted amongst the bold actors. I was so excited to be cast in this production. I've seen a lot of William's work as a director and as an actor. He's a very accomplished actor, too, before, and I was super excited to join the cast. It's a bunch of folks who are just really exciting actors, several that I've worked with before, but also folks that I haven't. A lot of clowns in the cast, mm-hmm. people who are amazing at physical comedy and at physical work, and I was just so excited to get to work with and learn from them. I'm playing Hermia in the show. Mm-hmm. Hermia is a sort of an ingenue type character. She's the girl that the two male lovers are both kind of fighting over in the beginning of the play. And she's often a bit of a kind of girly wallflower type character, and I was really excited to see if I could find more fire in her, more more danger, a little bit more grit, because she's often in the world of ingenues played kind of as an ingenue, and I was excited to find something a little dirtier, a little scrappier to her. So that's been really exciting to work on.
Excellent. So when, approximately what era is our Midsummer Night's Dream set?
We kind of have an anachronistic Midsummer. In the design conversations we've had, it's not necessarily a theme of how we're telling the story, but something we knew early on is we wanted to set a wide table and make sure that the best actors for the role were invited into our room. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that I wanted some gender diversity and some racial diversity, and, you know, we weren't producing this as a purely European art form, our designers kind of looked into just anachronistically what time periods we really saw queer life living to its fullest. So there were some images of, like, Weimar, the Kit Kat Club, and there was, like, the medieval revival period of Hollywood, and we looked at, Elizabethan thought. So it was kind of all over. But a guiding force for us was this idea of Met Gala, that is one place where you do see anachronistic fashions, that there's the idea of the ancient and the contemporary living in one garden party.
So when you have all of these different eras, is it character driven, or is it more like it's like a melange that's just there for the taking?
Yeah, I feel like we a lot of the designers were talking through mood boards, that there was an expressionistic quality of bringing all of these aesthetics together. Like when Ashley was talking about the design for the mechanicals, she wanted them to be a little piecemeal, a little piece of all of these worlds patched together to make this eventual great art piece at the end of the show. And with the fairies, we were really interested in natural dyes, and Ashley is kind of, her expertise is in, Ashley Renee, our costume designer,
okay,
her expertise is printing through natural dyes. So we used a lot of that in their costuming.
And Celeste, what's your palette?
Hermia is very, she's very pink. She is definitely a girly girl who is not prepared to go into the forest. I've got like a tiny mini backpack, and a little fan that I'm fanning myself with.
Does she wear like spike heels?
A lot of pink, a lot of clothes that are maybe not appropriate to be going on this outdoors trek in. And that's really been fun to play with.
Does she wear spike heels? Because that's the ultimate.
Not in heels, luckily, because our set would be a little treacherous to walk on in heels. We've got a lot of levels in the set. So the danger that it looks like from the audience of us traversing up and down these many levels, that is not actually dangerous in real life as the actor, but it's certainly something to navigate. So thank goodness they haven't put us in heels.
Excellent. So has the show opened yet?
We started previews this past weekend, and they've been going really well, but we don't officially open until this Saturday.
Ooh, okay. And you guys are doing this with the Shotgun Players. How long have you guys been associated with them?
I've been associated for kind of a long time. I did my first show a decade ago, I want to say. Triple Dino says no, but I directed Passing Strange a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. All right. And Celeste?
This is my first production with Shotgun. I'm super excited. I have been wanting to work with them for a while. They produce some of, I think, just the most exciting, most consistently really cool work in the Bay Area. So it's been really cool to get to work with them for the first time.
Yeah, I've yet to see a show. I've seen so many shows at Shotgun, and I've loved them all. So, you know, I keep waiting for one to disappoint me, and it never happens. So
keep waiting.
William, you said you've been directing with have you been just directing with Shotgun, or have you been acting and directing with Shotgun?
I acted at Shotgun last about a decade ago, I want to say, without getting too deep into the math. but I was out of the area for a little while.
Okay.
I do remember when I first moved to the Bay Area, like 16 years ago, mm-hmm. I saw a show at Shotgun, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've made it. I can work here. They just have such a specific, cool, young brand,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I was excited for Midsummer there.
Excellent, excellent. So you mentioned that the show opens this week. So for our people who don't know where Shotgun is, where and when is the show and where can they get tickets?
Okay, it's one of my favorite theaters also because it's really accessible.
Super convenient.
It's right across the street from the Ashby BART.
Mm-hmm. Right on the corner.
And I want to say that we're pretty sold out for a couple weeks, which not to toot our own horn. But if you do want tickets, you should jump online and grab those.
And where would that be online?
Oh God, I'm gonna get the website wrong. Do you know? I think it's shotgunplayers.com, but I want to double check that.
Okay.
Yes, it is shotgunplayers.org. Actually, shotgunplayers.org.
Okay. And what dates and times for the shows? How long is it going to run?
It right now runs through mid-April. Our shows are Wednesday through Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and most shows are they change every day.
Wednesdays and Thursdays are at 7:30, I believe.
Okay.
And yes, 7:30, and then Friday and Saturday are at 8 p.m., and Sundays are at like a late matinee, so they're at 5 p.m.
Oh, That's excellent. And if people want to find out more about what you as individual actors and directors are doing, how would they go about doing that?
Celeste?
Yeah, I don't have a website currently. I've been a little off the grid. But you can follow me on Instagram at hilariously bizarre title at Jessica Fire Stole My Stuff, which is an interesting story that... My house was broken into a couple of years ago, and a bunch of stuff was stolen by a lady named Jessica Fire, so I learned when she tried to use my Amazon account to purchase more things.
Wow.
So that is where you can find me.
I love that. And you, William?
That's the worst story. I'm so sorry. Well, you can find us together, because I'm sure that me and Celeste are going to work together.
Okay.
But I actually, I'm a co-artistic director at Oakland Theater Project, so oaklandtheaterproject.org.
Excellent.
Yeah, but if you want to find out about both of us, there are cast bios on the website. I just also want to mention that there's other ways to get tickets on that website. They have special prices for young people and student groups, and so check it out.
All right. Well, Celeste and William, I want to thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. People of Earth, this is your opportunity. Check it out. A Midsummer Night's Dream. Listening to 89.5 FM, KPOO, San Francisco. Yes, that is the Charlie Parker Quartet and Cosmic Rays. You can find that on the Beat Generation boxed set. It is 12:15. Who's about to touch your mind? Well, there's yet another show happening. This one called 39 Steps. And here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome one of the actors from said production, Renee Rogoff. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
I love that. You're amazing. Excellent. That is everybody's challenge for today, to feel amazing. So, Renee, 39 Steps. I know that there are people out there who have heard the title, but they don't know what it is. I know what it is, but I'm going to pretend like I don't and let you explain to our audience what 39 Steps is about.
So the 39 Steps is originally a Hitchcock film, mm-hmm. which is a thriller, which is what he's known for. And then they did a play that was basically taking that movie and turning it into a farce. The movie has like 150 characters in it. If you see it, there's just mm-hmm. a million things happening. And then in the play, we have four people playing those 150 characters, which is why it kind of leans into the hilarity and the absurdity of a lot of what we do. But it's great fun, and it's a great little romp, you know, a little bit of serotonin in a currently challenging world. Sure. We'll put it that way.
Now, I have a great affection for production pieces where people play multiple characters, going back to Bat Boy the musical. So the fact that you guys are doing, you take 150 characters and distill it down to four people, when you guys are making these when you guys are doing it on stage, how do you guys keep track of your however many, what is it, it's like a 35?
The funny thing is, in rehearsal, I mean, I think I literally shed tears at times because I would turn into a character, but then the voice was the character of the other one, and I was like, oh my God, I can't. I think we were, Greg Ayers, who is the other clown with me, there were times in previews where we were like, we would look at each other when we got off stage, because everything's just going so fast.
Uh-huh.
And we would just be like, okay, who am I now? who are we? What are we? Okay, right. We're Scottish salesmen. Okay, run and get the hat and go and be there before the light comes up. And it's just insanity, but it's great. It's easily the hardest thing I've ever done, I think.
Yeah.
Physically, because we're constantly running, if not on stage, backstage. In choreographed chaos, if you will.
So we're not just talking about voices. We're also talking about props and costumes. You've got to keep track of, you know, it averages at what, to like 38 per person? Or do some people get like 60?
So I think because some of the characters we play are puppets or shadows or...
Okay.
Or they're pre-recorded, and then we're doing something. I don't want to give too much away, but we're doing something along with the recording. And so I think actual physical on stage, like, how do I put it? Like, we're actually playing the characters with our bodies, mm-hmm. I guess is the way to put it mm-hmm. in this case. I believe Greg and I have 14 characters each.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes those characters are on stage at the same time, and we're quick changing on stage in front of your eyes as we're talking. And it's insane, and it makes you feel a little crazy, but when you land it, it's like some of the most satisfying things you'll ever feel.
So what's the plot what's the plot of 39 Steps?
Ah, yes. So the plot of 39 Steps, we follow the story of a man named Richard Hannay, who meets this woman, Annabella Schmidt, who is basically a secret agent,
mm-hmm.
and she's uncovered some sort of, and it's vague in the beginning, and I don't want to get too detailed, obviously, because I don't want to give too much away, but she comes across some intel that would highly affect, the safety of our world as we know it, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Okay.
And then he ends up being the hapless hero because she dies very early in the beginning, and it's him trying to I guess, follow the trail of breadcrumbs to get the information to the people that can stop this thing from happening. So it's actually like the underlying plot is very serious, and it is a thriller, and, you know, something very terrible has happened here, which we play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like tragedy fast, but at the same time, it's just completely peppered with slapstick, clowning, you know, gags and created environments by four people. So it's exhilarating to do. I'm hoping it's exhilarating to watch.
So Alfred Hitchcock was known for making cameo appearances in every single one of his movies. Does yep. Alfred Hitchcock make a cameo appearance in this play?
You know what? He does. But I can't, I'm not going to tell you.
You don't have to. You don't have to. I'm just thrilled.
Because it's, pardon me, it's actually, he does, and it's the most surprising way. And
okay.
I can't wait for people to see it because it's hysterical. Yeah.
All right. So you mentioned there are four of you. So we've got you, Renee Rogoff. Who else is in the play with you?
So Phil Wong plays our wonderful leading man, Richard Hannay. The wonderful Maggie Mason plays the three female presenting characters. So Annabella, Pamela, and Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
And then Greg Ayers and myself play everyone else. And I mean, literally at one point we play Snow. So, so we literally play everyone and everything else, including environments.
I love that. I love that.
It's really fun. It's kind of exactly the thing. I'll speak for myself as an actor. It's kind of exactly the thing that we get into this gig for,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity to play a million characters in, you know, I'll speak for my own characters. I play 14 characters with 7 different dialect accents. With neck breaking quick changes,
mm-hmm.
on and off stage in under 2 hours.
And you play Snow.
And it's absolutely a workout.
Uh-huh.
But it's kind of like the dream in a way to be able to do that and to really, you know, challenge yourself to create these characters, and so that the audience feels like, okay, now they're different. Now it's this person. Now it's this person. And so it's really, it's quite the honor to be a part of it. Susie DeMilano, our wonderful director,
mm-hmm.
was the captain of this crazy ship, and she deserves big credit. And Chelsea Pace was our amazing fight coordinator / clown coordinator / intimacy coordinator, and she deserves, you know, some flowers here as well, because mm-hmm. she made us look very sexy up there, so to speak.
So are all four of you?
Yeah.
Are all four of you clowns? Are all four of you clowns, or are some of them new to the clowning portion of it?
I'll out myself. This is my first clowning experience, and I have a newfound real respect. I've always loved clowns. I've
mm-hmm.
never been one of those "I'm afraid of clowns"
mm-hmm.
type of people. I've always kind of enjoyed them at the circus and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But after doing this, I bow to the clown community. So much respect. It's insane what you guys do on a daily basis. And I mean, it's insane what we do 8 shows a week. And I just have so much, I have such a profound, new respect for the clown, the art of clowning, truly.
Now, when you got the script and you're reading it and you saw that one of the characters was Snow, what was your first thought?
When one of my characters was what? Forgive me.
Snow. It's like you're reading it and you're going, Snow.
I got
Wait,
excited.
What?
Well, but I also like a big part of my personal acting toolbox is improv.
Mm-hmm.
I studied at Upright Citizens Brigade.
Oh wow!
And I performed in New York with them and stuff like that. And so, you know, when you tell me that I have to be an inanimate object, I'll find 12 ways to skin that cat, so to speak.
Wow.
And I'll give you like 12 options on what Snow should look like.
Wow.
Because I find it interesting. I find it hysterical. I find it compelling. You know, and so I'm also such a child at heart. And so I just love to play, which is why this is the thing that I do. But yeah, I think it was excitement that I was, all of it was excitement. There's also a little bit of nerves, right?
Mm-hmm.
As I outed myself, I'm technically not a studied clown. I've studied a lot of physical arts that can lean towards that practice, but the art of clowning is truly its own study. And I don't have that under my belt. And so I think there was in the beginning a little bit of like, oh man, I hope we can make this. I hope we get this right. And mm-hmm. I hope that I can make that clowning community that comes to see us proud, I guess, you know?
So it's at the San Francisco Playhouse. Have you guys opened yet?
We have. Our opening night was on the 13th, and it was amazing.
So for our listening audience who wants to see it, when and where for 39 Steps?
Yes. So we run until April 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And for tickets, you can visit the website, sfplayhouse.org.
Okay.
And we do 8 shows a week, two shows on Wednesdays and 2 shows on Saturdays, meaning we have a matinee and an evening offering.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so proud of this, and we'd love to share it with the San Francisco community. We all need a good laugh right now, I feel like.
Yeah, we all, always.
We are happy to provide that service.
Excellent. And Renee, how long have you been acting?
Oh, man. I'm really outing myself on the radio today, huh?
You could say since you were a child or since you were a teenager.
I've been acting for 35 years.
Wow. So you're a seasoned professional.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. It's weird to hear that out loud.
What, that you're a seasoned professional? Yes, you are.
Yeah.
So if people...
I think I'm just, you know, I just lily pad from gig to gig, job to job, project to project. And then the next thing you know, it's been 35 years, I guess. I don't know.
Well, you got to love it to do it. So hats off to you.
Yeah.
So if people want to find out more about what you're doing on a general, like how can they stalk you on the down low?
I normally have a website, which is down currently because I'm upgrading it, but
sure.
I am on Instagram. I am on all the socials, renee.rogoff, and yeah. That's how at the moment, yes.
All right. Well, one more time, 39 Steps is at the San Francisco Playhouse, and it plays through when?
Through April 20th.
And where is the San Francisco Playhouse?
The San Francisco Playhouse is at 450 Post, which is inside the Kensington Hotel on the second floor.
Excellent. Well, Renee Rogoff, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And the show sounds like a hoot, so I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Oh, my goodness. You're so welcome. And thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful to be here.
Excellent. All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity. You can go check out 39 Steps, 150 characters, 4 actors. It sounds like it's going to be a hoot and a holler. So just go see it and enjoy it. And enjoy it a lot. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. That's Miles Davis and Dîner au Motel. That's from Elevator to the Gallows. Before that, Ben Charest and Jazzy Bach from the Triplets of Belleville soundtrack. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. So many good shows. So many good shows. I got another one. It's called The Great Leap. And we're going to talk about it with one of the actors from The Great Leap. I'd like to welcome Edward Chen. Hello.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. How's it going?
Oh, I'm fantastic. The theater gave me housing, and I'm sitting in the backyard right now. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful day.
Excellent. Oh, that's excellent. So everyone I've talked to today has just been in a fabulous mood. So and that mood just translates to the audience. We've had one that's transcending and one that's, you know, so Edward, how long have you been acting?
Oh, boy. I've been acting for roughly 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of TV and film in L.A., but yeah, the culture of L.A. kind of was tough for me, just like on a spiritual level. So
I get that.
I moved back into theater, so mm-hmm. I've been doing nothing but theater for the past 3-4 years, and I've actually played this role 3 previous times, so this is my 4th time playing Wen Chong in The Great Leap.
Okay, so for our listening audience, what is the story of The Great Leap?
Yeah, well, I will just read the little blurb on our website. It's it says, when an American basketball team travels to Beijing for an exhibition game in 1989, the drama goes deeper than the strain between countries. For 2 men with a past and 1 team with a future, the game is a chance to claim personal victories on and off the court. Tensions rise right up to the final buzzer as a pivotal moment in history collides with the action in the arena. Driven by rapid-fire dialogue, this perceptive new play explores the cultural and political risks of raising your voice and standing your ground.
Okay, so that's that, but The Great Leap, let me ask you this, is it based on something that really happened? Who are the characters in it?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so Lauren Yee, she writes narratives about people who have been omitted from the archive, you know, lives that have been marginalized. Mm-hmm. And she often writes about Asians and Asian American history. So in our play, we're talking about the Great Leap Forward, which was a deadly famine that killed 30 to 45 million people in China. And we're talking about the Cultural Revolution. Now, these aren't things that are central to the play. They're more in the background.
Uh-huh.
I guess, I mean, I can speak in terms of my character.
Yes.
My character, you know, he went to, I mean, his backstory is he was in a re-education camp where, you know, he was subjected to hard labor, political humiliation, and physical torture. And, you know, the whole thing with the camp is to beat him into submission so he would be a loyal follower of Mao Zedong. So he's learned to keep his head down and just obey the rules. And that's caused him to push his loved ones away, right? And mm-hmm. So there is a character in this play that will bring that to the fore. I don't want to give away too
sure.
much. But yeah, it becomes a question of, you know, can he transcend this fear of being punished by the Communist Party and find love, find a way to take a stand, find a way to fight, you know? Yeah, and that all sounds like a big downer, because this play is actually, like Lauren has a very, very interesting way of writing, because she grabs you right away with like excitement and comedy. There's big laughs. The houses have been cracking up, and so the play starts with you really enjoying the laughter and the play with these characters. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then we start getting into the deeper things, what Nicholas, the director, calls the bass notes. Nicholas Avila is our director.
Okay.
You know, the heart of the play. So yeah, I just don't want to mislead anybody and think it's like this really heavy play. It's actually really funny. Sorry, go ahead.
You mentioned that this is your fourth time playing it. So each time you've played it, I'm guessing it's been over a long span of time. So did your understanding or approach change as you did it, as you did it repeatedly? Like because now you have more life experience, et cetera?
Oh, that's such a great question. Yeah, because it has been over the span of like 3 to 4 years that I played this role, and I've definitely grown as a person. So this is definitely, you know, my deepest portrayal of it, and I feel more connected to this man's experience than I ever have. And, you know, I got to credit Nicholas Avila for really, you know, he's been really driving us to go deeper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's kind of relentless about it in the best kind of way, right? So, I love that though. Like, I love the challenge because ultimately that's what it is, right? If we don't get to the emotional depths required, then the audience won't feel anything,
right?
So, you know, because I think in theater, when you're, which is different than being on a screen, right? When you're actually there in the room, looking at a real human being, having real emotions, your nervous system syncs up to theirs.
Mm.
And then, you know, when they have an emotional release, you have emotional release. And that's healing. That's empathy. And, you know, empathy is what brings us together, right? It's not feeling for someone. It's feeling with someone.
Right.
And I think especially now, you know, with Asian hate and all that going on, like, we need to understand that we are the same. Right.
Right.
But I feel like the challenge for me as an actor is to get to those emotional depths.
So who are the other actors that occupy or inhabit the roles on stage?
So we have, I mean, I love these guys. I'm happy to say their names. There's a character named Saul, played by Cassidy Brown. There's a character named Manford, played by James Aaron Oh. And the character of Connie is played by Nicole Tung.
Very cool. So you talked about the Great Leap, which was this huge famine, and I know nothing about that. Can you just tell us a little bit, what little bit you know about that?
Well, I would, okay, that's a good question, but I think, okay, so, the short answer is that Mao was trying to, you know, reconfigure China, so he had all these ideas, but it actually ended up really, really hurting people, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't even have food, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing that is most talked about in this play is the Cultural Revolution, you know, which was, you know, again, like I said, with my character, that's what's most relevant in this play, because my character is in one of the re-education camps, you know, where he's basically being brainwashed to be a loyal follower of the Communist Party. And he's, you know, like I said, subjected to terrible things like physical torture. And so the Cultural Revolution is more the thing that is present in this play. The Great Leap Forward, I mean, there you go. That's the play on the title, right? Mm-hmm. Is less prevalent. And because the Great Leap Forward happened many, many years before the Cultural Revolution.
Mm, okay.
So my character actually grew up in the Cultural Revolution. The Great Leap Forward happened when he was like a baby, I think, somewhere around there. So.
Okay. So has the show opened yet?
Not yet. It opens tomorrow.
Ooh, are you excited?
Oh, I'm so excited and nervous at the same time. Opening night is always like, woo, here we go.
Yeah. Well, before I ask you more the details of the play, since you are a person who's done both theater, stage acting, and then I'm guessing some television acting, what were there things about the television acting that as an actor you just weren't aware of, or conversely, were there things about theater acting that you weren't aware of? Because I don't know which one you got your start in.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're asking what was I not aware of as a television actor?
Because there seems like the way you approach acting on stage is quite different from the way you approach acting in front of a camera. So what are some of those things that aren't readily apparent when you first start doing one or the other?
Well, what comes to mind right now is all the starts and stops of shooting film and TV, right? Like, you shoot things out of order. You don't, you know, it's just like you get multiple takes, you do things over and over again. And you got to stand on these marks that are very specific. You know, I don't know. It just feels less organic, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you can find the organic within, you know, the TV and film world, but I feel like theater really opens that up, right? Because every night I get to play the character all the way through in order. I get to connect with a real live audience. And there's a lot of that for my character, right? I'm the narrator of the play, so I speak directly to the audience. So, and that's a joy. That's a joy to get the opportunity to look them in the eye and just connect directly to them.
Excellent. Well,
you know, and that's the thing. That's the thing that's different. It's just like, wow, there's bodies here that are here to see the show. This is awesome. Like, all right, let me tell you a story. Let's do this.
Well, for the people who want to hear that story, I know that it's playing at the Lesher Center for the Arts. So remind us when it opens, how long it's running, where can people get tickets?
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking. So you can get tickets at centerrep.org.
Mm-hmm.
CENTERREP.org. We open tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the showtime is at 7:30. I believe all the evening performances are at 7:30. And just a heads up, the first three performances are sold out.
Yay for you.
I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. But yeah,
and
did I cover everything?
Where is the Lesher Center for the Arts?
Oh, that's in Walnut Creek, in downtown Walnut Creek. I'm not from Walnut Creek, but
gotcha.
I assume it's in downtown. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Okay. And if people want to find out more about your acting career, how would they go about doing that?
Oh, wow. That's one of the things I'm trying to get on, is like build a website and stuff. So
okay.
I'd say just Google me. And hopefully you'll find my website at some point.
All right. Well, Edward Chen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, and I look forward to seeing the show.
Thank you, Marilyn. It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to enjoy the Great Leap.
This is a crazy pelt.
Well, there's a brand new documentary out about Carol Doda. Now, I'm born and raised in San Francisco, and when I was a little kid, she was already a part of the fabric of San Francisco, and I was way too young to know anything about the controversy surrounding her or the trailblazing that she did. She was just a given. Just everybody knew who she was. And now you're going to know who she was because I've got two filmmakers who worked on Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor. Welcome, Jonathan Parker and Marlo McKenzie. Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you, really.
So first of all, tell me a little bit about what were your roles in the documentary?
Well, we are the co-writers, co-directors, and co-producers.
And what was it about Carol Doda that drew you to do the documentary?
Well, I knew Carol personally. I met her about 25 years ago when she opened a lingerie store on Union Street after she retired from dancing. And I was a budding filmmaker at the time and got to know her and started talking to her about doing a film of her life. And she let me kind of follow her around for a few months on various strange little MC gigs and cocktail jazz gigs. And ultimately, the project didn't happen at that time, and I kind of put it in a drawer. And then fast forward 25 years, and
yes, so I found Jonathan's notes in a drawer, and I didn't know who Carol Doda was at that time, and I ended up looking her up, and it was immediately something that felt like it was very important because it's set in the 60s in this time that's quite revolutionary and specific to the story is the sexual revolution. And then also, you know, Carol, she was a trailblazer. She really broke the mold of what a woman was supposed to be at that time. And it's just a really fun and sexy story. And Jonathan and I were talking about all of that, and we decided we'd like to reopen his project.
I saw the documentary and I was absolutely fascinated. When you were sort of hanging out with Carol Doda, was she telling you all of these old stories, or were these things that you sort of found out in your research about her?
No, actually, it's all material that we found out. Carol was... as it comes across in the film, she was guarded about her past and guarded about her story. She's was a very sweet, sweet woman. And, you know, we got along great, but she was definitely not a fountain of information about her life story. So that really all came out as we were making the documentary.
That's amazing, because you have someone who's very open about her body, but very closed about her inner life.
Yeah, it's an interesting irony. It's not totally unusual. I mean, I do actually know other people who have are performers and you know, in a similar type of vein, and who also are very guarded about their privacy. So there must be some balance being struck there by those individuals.
So for our listening audience who may be slightly younger than me and don't know much about Carol Doda, give us the sort of the overview about Carol Doda and then some of the things that you found really intriguing about her story.
Yeah, Carol Doda was the first topless dancer in the nation in 1964. She rode down on a baby white grand piano that had been mounted to the ceiling at the Condor Club. And at the time, she was wearing a high fashion monokini designed by Rudy Gernreich. And so doing this was something that had not been done at that time in this kind of setting publicly. And so it was quite shocking to people. It was a really big deal to be topless in front of a crowd, and that kind of set off this like nationwide frenzy of, oh my gosh, is this legal? Is this obscene? Is this something we should allow? And women started dancing and performing topless across the nation. So she really changed the landscape of America.
Jonathan, when you met her subsequently, Was she still stripping, or did you sort of come to her in her rebirth or her new invention of herself?
Yeah, she had retired from dancing, but she was still performing. She was singing with a small jazz combo. She had telephone sex lines where she would kind of talk dirty. Teledota Inc., I think, was what she called it. She had the lingerie store. She was, you know, kind of trying to make a living, and like a lot of creative people who, you know, have a tough time making a living from their art. She had a lot of irons in the fire, and that's kind of the point in her career where I met her.
Okay, one of the things that blew my mind was that Melvin Belli took the case to try and defend her right to bear as much as she wanted. I found it astounding. Can you tell us a little bit more about that you discovered in your research?
Well, Melvin Belli had an office on Montgomery Street, right, like two blocks away from the Condor Club. So he was, and I don't know if you, you may not be old enough to remember, but he had a very public facing office on Montgomery Street, where he sat in his law office, which was totally visible in a big, huge picture window to anybody who was walking by. So he was somebody who was not shy for publicity. And so he would have been the logical choice for these dancers. And I'm sure he did it pro bono and was very happy to. He was kind of somebody who liked that nightclub environment and was kind of a part of that on some level. So he mixed that case in with defending Jack Ruby in the Oswald assassination, which was right about just maybe like 1 year before that.
It's amazing. No, like, as I said, being born and raised in San Francisco, when I was a little kid, like, everybody knew the name Carol Doda. But for me as a little kid, it didn't have, it was not on my radar that there was any controversy. I think everything had already been adjudicated. And she was basically like the marquee in streets of San Francisco. You just sort of took it for granted. But it's hard to sort of take yourself back to that time when it would have been really, really shocking. So for you who comes to it much younger, with sort of a clean slate, what were some of the revelations that you came to in researching Carol Doda's story?
Wow, there are so many things, but what is kind of like rising up right now and that I've been thinking about a lot are things that are specific to today, like topics that haven't really changed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, women on social media and men and everyone is kind of talking about the pressure to look a certain way, that there's like body pressure. There's so much pressure on, you know, getting Botox or facelifts or augmenting your body in some way. And Carol was kind of like at the heart of that. She was someone who injected liquid silicone into her breasts. And, you know, this was a choice she had to make too. She was getting pressure from people in the club, from people around her, from just that her size wasn't the right size for someone in her profession, but also she had this dream to do what she wanted to perform. She wanted to be in front of people. And so she made a conscious choice to turn her body into art and to augment her breasts so that she was a 44 bust line. And these are kind of choices we have to think about now. What are we comfortable with inside of ourselves versus what society is telling us is the thing we should do? And are we making these choices from a place inside of us where we're full and we love ourselves and this is something we're doing just to enhance ourselves? Or are we doing this because there's pressure and we don't feel like we're good enough? And this echoes until today. And Carol is kind of like one of the first people who really dealt with this in a public way. And that's what comes to mind for me first.
And then one other thing I wanted to just comment on was the silicone injections. Like, it boggles my mind that they were using commercial grade like industrial silicone. Like, that just blew my mind. And the quote unquote doctor that was like, sure, let me just put some in there.
Yeah, it's well, they thought it was safe too. That's also hard to kind of understand today. Like, what, you didn't know that might be dangerous? But yeah, they actually thought it was safe. And only a few years after they were doing the injections, other doctors started putting the silicone into the baggie as an extra layer of, or what, I don't know what it's called, into the bag that they use. So yeah, it was quite scary to think about what they underwent for to achieve their dreams.
Do we know how her children, was she ever able to make contact again with her children?
Yes, later in her life when she became ill, she did reunite with her son, and they became closer at that time. I don't really know the details of their relationship. Her daughter had already passed away earlier, so I don't think that they really ended up getting as, she didn't have the opportunity, from what I understand, to connect with her daughter as much as she had with her son late in her life.
So we're talking about Carol Doda, topless at the Condor. What would you say would be Carol Doda's lasting legacy?
Well, Carol was, I mean, there's a couple of ways to answer that. She, in terms of breast augmentation, she was obviously, you know, the first to really do that for entertainment value. And that really, that's like spawned, obviously, an enormous industry. But I think, you know, in thinking about what her courage at a time when options were pretty limited for women at this time, and she created a career for herself, and she wanted to be in show business. And as she says in the movie, she didn't know any other way than to start showing her business. And it's really pretty remarkable, where coming from a place that she was coming from, where she was very disempowered, and becoming a legend in San Francisco and a very famous performer, really even nationwide, because she became a tourist attraction. It's a pretty impressive legacy. And she remains, I mean, she passed away several years ago, but she remains very well thought of in San Francisco as a legend. And so I would think that's her legacy.
So when does Carol Doda, topless at the Condor, finally hit the public?
It's coming out. It's opening on March 22nd in San Francisco, LA, New York, and San Rafael. And then it is going to expand to 40 markets and 300 screens.
Wow, that's great. So if people wanted to find out more about your documentary stylings, how would they go about doing that?
Well, the Carol Doda movie is at caroldodamovie.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're talking about wanting to learn more about other projects that
John, yes,
I have going on, it's parkerfilmcompany.com.
How many documentaries have you done before this?
I have worked on, I worked on a four-part series, and then four or five. So like six, I guess I have one coming out this year. So they're kind of at the same time, but like six for me.
Wow. And I'm doing, this is my first documentary. I've done four, I've written and directed four narrative indie features. My first film was called Bartleby with Crispin Glover. And that was a opening night film at the New Directors New Films Festival in New York. I did a film called Untitled with Adam Goldberg, which is a satire about the contemporary art and music world.
Mm-hmm.
And a movie called The Architect with Parker Posey and Eric McCormack.
If people want to know more about the upcoming projects for both of you, how would they find that out?
Well, for this project, the CarolDodaMovie.com website will give you our histories are on it, and a lot of information about the documentary is on it. So we're really gearing up to the release of the film, and that would be a good place to start.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show today, and thank you for making this documentary. I found it fascinating, and I took the press releases and I gave them to friends because I was like, I had no idea any of this was going on, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we appreciate the opportunity. Thanks
thank
very
you
much.
So much, man.
Okay, People of Earth, Carol Doda, topless at the Condor. Much like Rice Aroni, she's a San Francisco.
Hi, tree. This is the almost famous Ben Fontores, and you're listening to KPOO 89.5 FM, San Francisco.